this Tiger Tour, you're either in with him or you are dead to him. Why would he change now? There's never been any in between. Let them coexist and divvy up the schedule, divvy up the players, and divvy it all up. Isn't that ultimately what it seems like we're working towards?
I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about. I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about.
Hello, this is Alan Shipnuck back for another Fire Drill podcast. There is a lot happening in the golf world, in society as a whole. We thought this might just be a good moment to for Matt Janelle and I to talk about the state of things. For me, it's kind of an exciting day. It's book release day of Live and Let Die, which some of you have already heard about or read about here in New York City, doing some publicity, all good stuff. Matt's in Oceanside in Fire Pit HQ. Maddie, how's it going?
It's going well. I mean, I feel like I'm busy until I heard where you've been and what you've been up to. So give a little more details on sort of exactly what you've been doing today.
Yeah. I think I've done 5 podcasts, 2 or 3 national radio shows. I've got my mint tea here in my throat. I'm losing my voice slightly. I hope it doesn't sound too bad for the listeners at home. I came to New York because I had some TV stuff lined up on MSNBC. Today I was going to do Squawk Box and Morning Joe, but with President Biden flying to Israel, with the House trying to elect a speaker, with war raging in the Middle East and elsewhere, those things get better ratings, I think, than golf books. So I got bumped. Hopefully tomorrow. I'm locked in for CNN tomorrow and maybe a few other things, but it's all good. I'm just happy to be here. Enjoying the room service of my hotel, which I haven't left this room since 10 a.m. It's now 5:20 p.m. Like, I literally haven't left the room. It's just been ping-ponging from one thing to the next. But I appreciate the interest and people wanting to talk about the book. And it's been fun. I mean, I'm probably tired of my own voice, but hopefully nobody else is yet.
Well, there are probably a few people.
I mean, probably.
I know a few tour pros have voiced the idea that they're tired of you.
Well said. And
good God. I mean, honestly, given the state of what's happening in the world and the devastation and destruction and just terrorism and sadness, and the idea of sort of talking about anything other than that or seeing anything other than that is, you know, here we are covering the game of golf. And I think it's just a good reminder and perspective on, you know, what it is we do and how we do it, and try to, you know, certainly tell stories that in some cases, to Justin Thomas's point, were, you know, positive stories. You know, look, it's not all positive, and it's not always positive. And I know you're at the axis of this fantastically layered, I don't know, dysfunctional fight for professional golf. And for me, before we get too far into it, it's just worth stating that, you know, it's also a good reminder that professional golf is only a sliver of what is golf, capital G-O-L-F, you know. And that to me is also something that I try to remind myself. You know, I've certainly sent out a lot of tweets that I often think, oh, maybe I probably shouldn't have sent that out, or, you know, maybe I should have sat on that an extra day or reworded that a little differently. And, you know, the more I read of what you write, the more I'm hyper-focused on the other side of the game, which is, you know, instead of people who get paid to play, people who pay to play. Because I think that to me is truly what golf is. And I think some of the guys who are getting paid to play some of those guys, you know, men and women at one point had to pay to play. And I think they're not too far removed from that. And, you know, I think we'd all be better served to keep things in perspective from time to time when this kind of stuff gets so far out of control, which I believe is where it's at right now.
Well, it's a good point. I mean, folks have been following us carefully know that we're monitoring and chronicling this big renovation at Golden Gate Park Golf Course, right in the heart of San Francisco. And I was up there just last week. They, you know, I was there in February, the last day that the old course could be played by it's just this treasured little respite in the heart of the city for the local golf community. And talking to the folks about how much the course means to them. And there was a little trepidation like, yeah, this is our course. I mean, it's not perfect, but we like it. You know, we're sorry to lose it. And what's been created there is just phenomenal. It is going to be one of the best par threes in the country. And so they kind of had a soft opening and they had 24 young women who were part of the first tee. Really, they're girls. They're all teenagers. And they came out and played, and the joy they exuded, because it's just a fun, whimsical design and a beautiful setting. And you get up to the top of the property, you can see the ocean, you can see the famous windmills out there and the outer sunset. And there's glimpses of, you know, the real urban, tightly packed in houses and buildings. And you have a real sense of place. And just being around those kids, as you suggest, Matt, it is affirming, and it is a reminder of what it's all about. And I mean, we tell a lot of those stories here at the collective, you know, whether, you know, let's go through the roll call of all the heartwarming stories we've done in the last year or two. I mean, there's so many. Like, you and I are both of our hearts are in municipal golf and in public golf. And we've been chronicling that, you know, pretty much nonstop. In parallel, you know, I have been writing about this battle for the solo professional golf. And so hopefully that's interesting to fans. You kind of get a taste of everything, and readers and viewers and listeners. You know, we're not predictable, I think, here at the Fire Pit. We're always chasing different stories, and some are really uplifting and feel good. Some, like, you know, I dropped one today on firepitcollective.com, kind of gets into this current moment in geopolitics and in what that means for the framework agreement. And it's complex, and it's a little dark, and it's a little edgy. And I like that mix for us. And hopefully our fans are into it as well. But definitely we're like pitchers that have a fastball and a changeup and a knuckleball and a curveball. I think if you come to firepitcollective.com, you don't know what you're going to find. And to me, that's a great thing, but there's a wide disparity.
Well, going through your article and your book and then all the, you know, sort of the preliminary feedback, because the preliminary feedback on Phil, I think for a lot of people, assumed one thing, and by the end of the book they realized another, which is it was beyond fair and balanced and actually skewed more towards the positives that Phil has done and is capable of doing. But there's another side to him that, you know, right or wrong, like or dislike, agree with or disagree with, it's just who he is. As you're navigating this free flow of politics, egos, money, which comes with greed, and then this concept of like a future, right? Because at some point the professional game of golf is going to end up somewhere, right? Where it is now at the end of 2023, what it will be in 2024, what I think people hope it will be by 2025 is sort of what is sort of, that is the heart of the matter, right? Like what is the end game here? Who's in charge? And like, where's the money coming from? How much money is going out? Like, that to me is so, we are so far from where it's going to end up. It just seems, it's mind-boggling to me.
and farther than people think. And that was one of the reasons why I wrote this story, because even though the book's done, I'm still plugged into so many people and I'm always talking to them. And I got a guy on the phone. He's a big New York finance titan. This is just 3 or 4 days ago now. And he's very involved in the conversations around the framework agreement. And I said, is this thing going to be done by December 31st, which is supposed to be when it's going to expire? He said, no, it's not. It's like, it's a mess. There's too many egos. There's too many players, too many cooks in the kitchen. Like, he said, it's going to get extended and it's going to keep changing. And it's been leaking out in other places about, all these private equity firms and other institutional investors who are trying to get in on the deal. And, it makes sense. You know, what this so-called merger, this big deal that was trumpeted, it was nothing more than pinky promises. There's nothing in that document that's binding, except for, you know, basically extinguishing the lawsuits. Like, that's a done deal. That's happened. That was a win for the tour. But otherwise, you know, there's a line in there about the Saudis have the first, you know, the PIF has the first right of refusal for outside investment. That was aspirational. That's not the truth. That's why the tour is, they've got upwards of 10 bidders now who want to get in on the deal, and they can either come in alongside the Saudis or they can push the Saudis out entirely. And there's pros and cons either way from the PGA Tour perspective. But so this deal is miles from being done, and it's going to extend in 2024, and it's going to get a lot messier. So, yeah, to your point, Matt, I mean, it's a moving target, what the game's going to look like. It's never been less certain. You know, I think the announcement of the framework agreement kind of tricked people into thinking that was the end game, but it's really not.
Wouldn't you say that where we are today, and based on your this article and some of your reporting even after you hit send on the book, you feel like professional golf, is further away from a clean and clear future than it was the day they announced this so-called pinky promise or promises?
Yeah. It makes sense from Jay Monahan's standpoint. I mean, the tour needs $2 billion of investment. That's the number they've settled on. They can't pay their bills. Their model's outdated. It's time to basically shift the tour as business model. And that's a good thing. I mean, you look at the money that's flooded into English Premier Soccer and every other sport, really. It was time for the tour to have access to that, because the old model of every year, you got to go back to some corporation, some CEO, and try and squeeze another $1 million or $2 million out of them. Like, now the tour is going to have a war chest that it can invest in its product, better TV, better streaming, better social media, and, you know, more interesting tournament offerings. Like, they will have the money to do that. This is a good thing for golf fans. The issue is, where is the money going to come from? It can be entirely the PIF, but we know that comes with political risk. I mean, the lawmakers on Capitol Hill are watching this very carefully, because it would set a precedent for all of professional sports. Because, you know, if the Saudis can take over golf, why wouldn't they try and buy an NFL team and a Major League Baseball team and an NBA team? And so, this is something that the professional sports are going to have to grapple with. And it just turns out that golf they're the first guys in the door. And so, if I think the dream scenario for the tour is that Yasir to maintain his position as in this new entity and, you know, have the proverbial seat at the table, if he would allow some other US based investment to come in alongside the Saudis, which would dilute their equity and dilute the Saudi influence, that becomes much more palatable to the golfers, to the golf fans, and to Congress. Say, hey, yes, we welcome the Saudis into this as a minority investor alongside all these other companies, these blue chip American companies, and that becomes a much easier sell. Or they can totally cut bait with the PIF and go all in with U.S. money, and that would obviously make a lot of people happy in the golf ecosystem. But the risk in that is then you live golf a staunch competitor again, and now Yasir's pissed, and he's still got the checkbook. So the tour's trying to thread the needle here, and that's why the negotiations are bogged down, and that's why the future's so uncertain, because they have there's you know, kind of these three different possible outcomes, and each one has a definite upside and has a definite risk. And so, now you've introduced all these other people into it, you know, all these private equity firms, Ari Emanuel from Endeavor, the big Hollywood agency, like they're bidders. They have their own advisors and lobbyists and lawyers. And so the cast just keeps expanding. The conversations keep multiplying. It was already a complex deal, and now it's complexity squared.
Tiger, Rory, Steinberg, Tiger's inserting himself and a seat on the board. Mm-hmm. And again, from where I sit and all that I know and what he brings, look at how much money they've raised for their sort of, I don't know what you call it. The
it's a breakaway tour. League.
It's like, a breakaway league, right?
Like just like LIV Golf.
It's another, you know, I can't wait for that to get official World Golf Ranking points before LIV, which would be amazing. But you know, doesn't it like Tiger and Rory and Steinberg have drawn lines in the sand, right? They are. And so that's like when you say like the tour's trying to thread the needle, I guess my response to that is, yeah, maybe the tour is trying to thread the needle, but isn't Tiger and Rory and all that comes with that, you know, business, that's the furthest thing they want to do. They actually want to do anything but thread the needle. They'd rather create the money on their own, generate the money on their own, be solely, you know, be independent. They've made that very clear. And thus the scenario of having LIV then go and be a separate entity and pick players and essentially have a little, now the Tiger Tour, which is what you should probably just call it at that point. Yeah. Once that then becomes separate, this Tiger Tour versus then Tiger's the guy who's like, okay, if you go over there, then you're gone. Like that's the way he's always operated. You're either in with him or you are dead to him. Why would he change now? There's never been any in between. It's very clear that would be then the Phil League versus the Tiger League. It's, you know, it's the Saudi money, the PIF money versus any other money other than whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And then let it be, and then let them coexist and divvy up the schedule, divvy up the players, and divvy it all up. Isn't that ultimately what it seems like we're working towards?
I mean, everyone is compromised in this. You know, Tiger and Rory are on the board of directors of the PGA Tour. They are also the co-founders of this TGL, and so which the tour is invested in. They share intellectual property. So Tiger and Rory want to protect this new league they've created, but that really benefits them and the players they've given a piece of the league to, which are all tour guys. No LIV players have been invited. Not Brooks Koepka, not Dustin Johnson, who everybody still loves. Like the TGL has become a vehicle to continue to buy the loyalty of these guys who've stayed loyal to the PGA Tour, and it's like a reward. You get to be in the boys' club, and so. When this deal gets presented to the board of directors of the PGA Tour in whatever fashion it is, Tiger and Rory are going to have to vote on it. And something I've learned is that it has to be unanimous. It's in the tour constitution to change the tour's bylaws and to change its fundamental governance structure. It has to be a unanimous vote by the board of directors. So now you have Patrick Cantlay, who we know is a rascal in the middle of a lot of things, and it's going to be like in Congress when you know there's one holdout in the Senate, you know, to break a tie, and all of a sudden, we're going to build a new military base in Alaska, and we're going to, like, you know what, like all the pork that goes into all these bills, like potentially facing that scenario where the tour has made a decision, you know, the Jay Monahans and Jimmy Dunns, and they've kind of hammered out a deal, and now the players have to ratify it, but they have their own selfish interests, which are very different from the, you know, what Tiger and Rory, their concerns about the TGL have nothing to do with what, you know, Peter Malnati is trying to keep his card, you know, who's on the board as well. And a Webb Simpson, who's coming to the end of his playing days, it appears like, so it's, this whole process is so interesting and so revealing. And so, yeah, that how, who's going to vote, how they're going to vote. And of course there'll be tons of conversation to get to that point. And it was quite interesting that, you know, this guy, Colin Neville, he's at Rain Capital. He was appointed to be an advisor to the player directors, basically the Tiger, Rory, Cantlay, Webb Simpson, Peter Malnati, to advise him on the deal. Like, so Jay and Jimmy cannot pull another end around, you know, like, especially like say Jimmy Dunn, he's a very, very sharp businessman. He understands things at a granular level that no mere golfer ever could. And so he can outfox these guys, but you know, they brought in Colin Neville to kind of joust with him and explain it to the players on this human level. And so it's, you've got all these warring camps that are potentially going to have to come to a unanimous agreement for anything to get done. So the layers of intrigue, I mean, it's like trying to elect a new pope, or you know, it's just, there's, it's all happening again in secret. And we're going to just have to wait for the next puff of smoke to come out of the chimney and see where this process is.
Part of the negativity or the response to your excerpt, latest excerpt, and the book in general, just me, you know, going through some of the comments, certainly maybe by the players too, as they try to kind of move on or brush aside or get to where they need to go, is that you're bringing up a lot of stuff that took place a year ago. You know, you're bringing back up or revealing stuff that was said when tensions were high amongst those players, when stuff was actually going down in terms of guys were leaving or not leaving, had one toe in, but didn't, you know, ultimately pulled back for whatever reason. Is that fair to say? Is that the sense you're getting, is that a lot of these people involved would just assume not have all that stuff come out now, given the fact they're trying to like move on and come to some sort of, you know, comprehensive conclusion?
Yeah. Oh, they would love to sweep it all under the rug. Of course that serves their interests, you know, like,
yeah,
you know, that was Justin Thomas's critique. It was basically like, can't you just say only nice things and, you know, not dwell on this other stuff. But it's like, this is how we got to this moment. And I just think it's so important for golf fans to understand, like, all this all just happened in the shadows. Right. And so no one knows how we got to this moment. It's been a series of cover-ups, in low-key cover-ups, and there's these information wars where everyone's trying to control the narrative. And what bothers a guy like Justin Thomas is he can't control me, and I'm just gonna tell it like it is. What everything I've learned, everything I've been told from both sides, synthesize it and create, you know, what I think is the true story of what actually happened. But people, you know, the players, the other Jay Monahan, Greg Norman, they don't want that. They want only their version to go out. And a guy like Justin has been spoon-fed a lot of stuff from Jay Monahan and Jimmy Dunn, and basically told, it's fine, we got this under control, don't worry about it, we're looking out for your interests. And in the end, it turned out not to be totally true. But it's like they've become reliant on the official version of events, but that's often not the case. Like, how many press releases go out, you know, about an officer involved shooting, and it's, you know, the passive language, and it seems you don't really know what happened, and no one pays attention. Then the truth comes out and it's something darker. And I'm not saying that this battle is on par with that, but there's like the official version that the powers that be are peddling often turns out not to be the case. And, you know, my job in this has been to cut through all that and find the real truth and the real heart of this story. So Is that inconvenient for some players and some bureaucrats? You know, obviously, but that, I don't think that's really my issue. It's theirs.
Well, the other thing is, and this is my sense again, cause we spend a lot of time comparing notes and having conversations. For every Justin Thomas or Brooks Koepka, who are obviously in these elite level of, you know, fraternities and boys clubs per, you know, how we saw the Ryder Cup play out and how, you know, just the whole dysfunction of that whole process. But for every Justin Thomas or Brooks Koepka that says, oh, we're sick of Alan Shipnuck, I would imagine you probably get a lot of text messages, phone calls, and DMs from a whole slew of other players saying, thank God for you, because we don't have a voice in the room. We don't actually have any idea of what's going on and never will, because we're that filter of communication and information is never, it's always going to cut short of me being ranked 56th or 65th or 165th in the professional golf world. And they're like, please, you're our only source of actual information, because whatever else we're getting is just a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah, it's been interesting. I have gotten those kind of comments, and it is just such a polarizing subject. And even the media environment got polarized, where, you know, a lot of people were reflexively pro tour, anti live. And I tried to not get sucked into that and kind of understand what was going on. So like when the framework agreement was announced and, you know, Jay and Jimmy were doing their media tour saying, we won, we've got all the power, we've got the board seats, you know, this is great for us. And I've been talking to people on Live all along. And so they were telling me their version of events. And when I tried to counter this prevailing tour narrative that, you know, actually Yasir has the money, he has the power, I got so much pushback from either other, you know, even other members of the golf media. But, you know, they had not been to a Live event. They don't have any sources there. They don't talk to any of the players. They don't talk to any of the executives. And so just by trying to tell a complete story, it bothers some people because they only want to hear that one version. And I mean, of course, it's symptomatic of modern life where, you know, look at political consumption of news. Like if you only watch Fox News or you only watch Rachel Maddow, you know, you have a very specific worldview. And when it gets countered, people get upset, they get mad, they start shouting at you. It's like, well, I'm not saying I'm right and you're wrong. I'm just saying, have you considered this? And, but it's an increasingly difficult conversation to have in America today on any topic. And because this is grown from a golf story to a political story, then, and of course Trump's in the middle of everything, and he's obviously a very polarizing figure that it's turned the volume up on all this. So there's naysayers and there's supporters that, you know, at every level, whether they're players, whether they're fellow media members, whether they're just people on social media. But I try and tune all that out and just like focus on telling the story, and whatever the reaction is, I can't control that. But this is what I think the story is. And if you stick to that, I think you can avoid getting sucked in and getting off track. But
I see you as Ben Affleck in The Accountant, in that room where he sequesters himself for like a day, and he goes through all the pens and he writes the, you know, the long equation of how all this adds up, and the sum total of it is just, he essentially finds all the darkness in the equation itself and how the numbers don't match up, and they don't like what he finds out, and you're just ripping through all these pens and all this paperwork, and you're getting to the sum total of the dysfunction, the greed, the egos, the politics, and the bullshittery.
that's a great image. I love it. But you know, part of why we kind of wanted to have this discussion is because there's so much happening all around us. And like, you just came in hot from Las Vegas. There was this big convention of sort of thought leaders in golf around sustainability, around water. And, you know, you and I just talking offline, it really sparked my interest. I wanted to, can you take people into the room a little bit, Matt, and what you learned, and just kind of set the scene? Because again, it's like, we're all affected by what's happening in Palestine. Does that have anything to do with water consumption in Las Vegas? Of course not. But somehow golf gets mixed up into all these things where you know, MBS puts out a statement that can affect the framework agreement. What happens? The future of water is going to directly affect golf and how we all play and enjoy it. And so, you know, you and I are always trying to connect these threads, but what did you learn out there?
Well, yeah, I was asked to go to Las Vegas of all places to talk about water, which at the face of it, you're like, oh, they're having it was the Colorado Basin Golf and Water Summit. The National Golf Course Owners Association put on back-to-back days of golf business tech. It was Golf Business Tech Con that rolled right into the Colorado Basin Golf and Water Summit. To summarize what I learned being sort of in the bloodstream of both those days would be very tough. I'm still processing a lot. I took copious notes and was learning from a lot of different perspectives, voices, experts, panelists, you know, tent poles of the game. Golf, here's, you know, there's the good news is there's a lot of smart people trying to figure out the issue that revolves around water, not only as it relates to golf, but as it relates to humanity. So I walked away feeling much more positive about the amount of research, the passion, the experts, you know, that are involved in trying to make sure that, again, forget golf for a second, that we as a society will continue to be able to, you know, have a sustainable future. I mean, that's, you know, and I think that was shared by a lot of people in the room. I wish more people were in the room to hear what was said, to ask questions that they might have or not have. Jay Caron, National Golf Course Owners Association, Rhett Evans of the Golf Course Superintendents Association of America, Don Ray, Vice President of the PGA of America, Craig Kessler, Southern California Golf Association, and Matt Pringle from the United States Golf Association, all in the room. Okay. That was important. You know, Don Ray from, I don't know if you know him, from the PGA of America, Vice President in line.
Just by reputation. Know, yeah. President.
Oh my God. A powerhouse, someone who grabbed the microphone, never spoke from a single note, talked about how and pointed out how the National Golf Course Owners Association should be commended for the fact that they're one of the most underfunded organizations in golf, and yet they put together these you know, conferences, these summits, to create this you know, these days of information and best practices and information sharing situation that I think a lot of people benefited from. That, you know, Don Ray stuck out to me, and as an organization that, you know, has the 16,000 members, he said that 4,000 of his members are going to be directly impacted by water on an ongoing basis, right? So that's, think about the members of the PGA of America. A fourth of his membership are going to be dealing with water issues on a regular basis. So he admitted, hey, maybe we haven't been in the room as often as we probably should have. We are here now, and we are here to stay. Like, that was a big takeaway for me. The PGA of America, you know, the USGA is doing things and are going to committed to doing ongoing things to try to create, you know, better practices as relates to water and sustainability. We're seeing what's going in Alistair McKenzie's famed greens at Paso Tiempo and understanding better about how that irrigation process, you know, works. And all of those little things matter. You know, what's being done at Golden Gate Park, you know, the removing of all the thatch that comes with a golf course that's gotten, you know, long in the tooth. Well, that thatching is a problem because that water is not going into the ground, and therefore, you know, it's not being sort of reused in a way that is sustainable. So, I mean, at a federal level, this woman Stacey Wade was in the room. She provided a lot of incredible information about what's happening at the federal level to try to support the states as they manage and try to create better sustainable futures for the states. A woman by the name of Colby Pellegrino, you can't make it up, Colby Pellegrino, is the Deputy General Manager of Resources at Southern Nevada Water Authority, was an absolute rock star. So between, I don't know, Don Ray and Colby Pellegrino, I was like, these two really stuck out to me as people who are making a difference and are going to continue to make a difference from, you know, a state level. She, you know, Nevada will be at an all-time low in terms of how much water they're using from the Colorado River in 2023. That's important because almost all of, you know, all of their water is imported, right? They're not getting any natural water.
Yeah.
So I don't know, Paul Roetzer from, you know, from artificial intelligence, he's an authority in AI. He was the big takeaway from the Golf Business Tech Con. You know, the National Golf Course Owners Association and what they're doing, the fact that all those tent poles were in the room, Don Ray, you know, being who he is and the potential impact he'll have going forward, what Nevada in the state of Nevada is doing to be sustainable and creating a blueprint or an answer key for what other states are going to have to try to, you know, wrangle over the course of the future and a depleted water, you know, water resources is the kind of stuff that I'm trying to process as I leave Nevada and go back over my notes and try to kind of wrap my brain around the future of, again, humanity, but then again, golf as well. There was one guy also worth mentioning because he made such an incredible, impassioned speech. I wrote his name down. Pat Christopher, Director of Agronomy at Red Ledges in Heber City, Utah, you know, essentially saying conservation works, and asked the question, if we had to start building golf today, what would it look like? If we know what we know now about water resources. And, you know, I did that story on Pasatiempo in 2015 for Golf Channel during Water Week about how they diversified their portfolio and essentially made a deal with Scotts Valley, who has an incredible reclamation a plant in which some of a big chunk of their reclaimed water was going out to the ocean. And then, you know, Scott Hoyt and Justin Mandan and the membership at Pasatiempo were able to make a deal in which they get that reclaimed water from neighboring Scotts Valley. That was a huge success story that Pasatiempo is benefiting now. Well, if we can have more of those stories, again, is that a golf story or is that a business story as it relates to, you know, Santa Cruz, Pasatiempo, the people who come from Scotts Valley, work at Pasatiempo, the property values in and around that area, that the ripple effect of connecting the dots and making sure that water isn't just going out to the ocean. Goat Hill Park going from potable water to reclaimed water is the reason why John Ashworth has a sustainable business model at this community asset, in which now it's a thriving, you know, piece of the Oceanside community, bringing national interest from all over the world. Well, that doesn't happen if he doesn't connect those dots and get the politicians to make the necessary changes so that he's on reclaimed water instead of potable water. You know what I mean? Like, all of this is so connected. You know, positive stories, as you mentioned, Golden Gate Park, Youth on Course, how much, you know, we're working, you know, in step with them. They have 2,000 courses under contract, and 190,000 kids who are now members who now have access to the game of golf for $5 or less. Accessibility, affordability, you know, sustainability as it relates to sort of kids getting in the game of golf and having the life experiences that have changed our lives and so many people who listen to this podcast. Western Golf Association, Evans Scholars, Canal Shores, what Kemper Sports, WGA, and so many other local and privatized investors are doing to try to help Canal Shores turn that business model around, which is going to be attached to the Western Golf Association and the kids that are going to get access to that golf course, plus the junior caddy programs that are going to be involved. Maggie Hathaway, which we did a feature on last year leading into the US Open, which we know is about to get $15 million inserted into that municipal golf course, plus Cobbs Creek in Philadelphia, Bobby Jones, that success story in Atlanta, you know, and then all leading up to the Wishbone Brawl, which will happen November 11th, in which Xander Schauffele, who might get dragged into some of these conversations as it relates to whatever is happening at the professional game. Oh, by the way, this is a guy who for the last 6 years has donated time and money and resources into North County Junior Golf. He went to San Diego State from the area. He's, you know, given a ton of time and money into making sure this Wishbone Brawl, in which they play Persimmons at a 4,600 yard golf course, with the likes of Dean Wilson, Jeff Ogilvie, Fred Couples, Charlie Hoffman, Chris Riley, local pros like Will Kropp and Colin Featherstone is playing this year. And then this beautiful component of the story this year in which Jasmine and Janae Laveo, who started in North County Junior Golf, caddied at some of the first few Wishbone Brawls, now are playing at Long Beach State and are going to compete together as partners in this year's Wishbone Brawl, competing against Ogilvie and you know, either Will Kropp or Chris Riley or Colin Featherstone and Xander Schauffele. And on their bags are going to be the Lee twins, Ada and Annabelle, who caddied for Fred Couples and Will Kropp last year. Fred Couples and Jeff Ogilvie last year. Fred Couples and Will Kropp the year before. Ada and Annabelle Lee are going to be caddying for Jasmine and Janae, two pairs of twins who have grown up playing in North County Junior Golf. So you want positive stories? That's what we're also working on. Oh, by the way.
Well said. Yeah. It's, you know, it used to be this time of year was slow in golf. You know, it's like, it just never ends. There's so much intrigue, but it's heartening to hear about the water symposium. And it's cool that you were there because otherwise it wouldn't be disseminated. You know, the folks in that room don't necessarily have platforms or megaphones or know how to get the information out. And so, it's valuable that you would take the time to immerse yourself in that. And obviously it'll inform whatever reporting we do going forward on these environmental things. But, anyway, it's always fun to check in with you, Matt, and just, see what you've been up to and what's on your mind. Obviously, I've been paddling hard here as well. So it's kind of fun to have these state of the fire pit discussions occasionally and bring people behind the curtain a little bit. Anything else we need to touch on before we release the listeners?
No, I mean, I'm heading off to San Francisco. Jay Blasey's picking me up at the airport tomorrow. I'm going to go get eyes on what ultimately is the finished product of that Golden Gate Park project, in which Dan Burke deserves a ton of credit as the guy who runs the first tee of San Francisco and, you know, really got the ball rolling as it relates to this project and got, you know, privatized investors into making what's going to be a huge difference just down the street from Harding Park. You know, and Dan brought in Jay, who is donating his fees to be a part of this 9-hole restoration, renovation, renaissance of this piece of property. Josh Lewis has been critical in helping Jay and the San Francisco City Parks Department make sure that, you know, what they're doing from an agronomics standpoint is going to be sustainable and make sure that this golf course remains playing and playable as Jay sort of envisions it. So I'm going to be seeing that tomorrow. And then I'm going to a Youth on Course board meeting on Thursday. Again, honored to be a small part of what Youth on Course is doing. And then I'm going to be busting down to Wilshire for another one of your book signings at Wilshire Country Club. So, I mean, the game of golf, going back to the beginning, is so much more than just the people who get paid to play. And it dominates our eyes and the optics of what we see on a day-to-day basis. But I just think it's important, and everybody listening knows this, you know, we're working on a story on the father-daughter, Anya Donegan from La Hinch and the impact she had on the Women's U.S. Open from a little town next to La Hinch. I mean, what we're doing and how we're doing it is so much more than just, you know, you writing these books, which is a huge chunk of effort and energy to try to like peel back and shine a light into those deep, dark corners and shadows of the professional game. But when you do something like a water symposium, or you go to something like a Youth on Course board meeting, or you go to Golden Gate Park and realize, you know, everything is connected and it's important to keep some perspective and not just yell, but sometimes listen.
I love it. Perfect mic drop. That was Matt Janella. This is Alan Shipnuck. Thanks for going along on this little journey with us through the life and times of the Fire Pit Collective this minute. We generally like to tell other people's stories, but once in a while, it's kind of worth looking at what we're up to individually. So appreciate you, Maddie. To the listeners, thanks for sticking with us. As always, thanks to our corporate supporters at Link Soul and at Dormy. In fact, should actually probably, since we're paying bills right now, I should say that Dormy has created some beautiful leather head covers that have that skull icon from the cover of my book. And if you're into it, it's worth checking out. Oh yeah, we have hats. The hats just came in. They look amazing. So we do this because we love telling stories, but we like to keep the lights on as well. So thanks to our sponsors as always. This is another Fire Drill podcast. We'll be back in your ears soon. For now, that's the end. Thanks for listening.
I bet big and I played to win. Made a fortune when my ship came in. I ran the table, never thought I could fall. Then the winter time hit me like a cannonball. And now I can't shake this losing streak. Every road I take is a dead end street. I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think what I'm thinking about. I got thoughts in my head, can't get them out. Trying not to think